We look at the world once in childhood. The rest is memory. These words are from the last lines of Gnostos, a poem by Louise Gluck. The poem reminds us of the distinction between memory and fiction. It reminds me of how colorful my childhood memories are and how memory in general is kind of a resilient thing. How we remember things for a long time and we remember long ago things best. And yet sometimes this long-held memory is pretty inaccurate, and the version of the truth varies depending on who you talk to. In fact, memory is a pretty interesting topic when it comes to memoir. That's why this lecture tonight is on Mary Carr and her book, The Art of Memoir. Today's lecture is for East and West Learning Connections. This lecture was given on April 13th, 2022, live on Zoom, and was followed by a lively discussion. The lecture was hosted by East and West Learning Connections, a group that helps people of different heritages break cultural barriers and get connected through learning, communicating, mentoring, and volunteering programs. For more information about East and West Learning Connections or to attend one of their events, please visit www.eawlc.org or click the link in the podcast description. This year, every week on the second Wednesday of the month, we do a lecture and discussion of a novel or memoir. I'm really glad to be a part of their lecture series. In the first part of the lecture tonight, I want to discuss the role of poetry in memoir, the role of memory, and the importance of life stories. We'll talk about chapter one, The Past's Vigor. In the second part of the lecture, I'll talk about the chapter on information, facts, and data, and the preface of the book. The topics for that part are about the importance of information, of showing and telling, and about noticing what's human in our experience. So let's start with some definitions. What is memoir? Memoir is a kind of life writing. It's much like autobiography. It's the story of a life written by the person who lived it, but we use the words a bit differently. Autobiography tends to tell the whole story. It's usually viewed as containing more information. It's a complete record of life events. Memoirs, on the other hand, have a reputation for being romantic and for picking and choosing bits of one's life to showcase. At the start of chapter one in The Art of Memoir, Mary Carr provides us with a quotation from Louise Gluck, and the quotation says, "We look at the world once in childhood. The rest is memory." This is from a poem by Louise Gluck. I like this quotation and the poem because it reminds me of the distinction between memory and fiction. It reminds me of how colorful my childhood memories are. We remember things for a long time, and we remember long ago things best, in some ways. I mean, I'm 47, and yet I would say that my childhood years, though they are less in number, those years are somehow more memorable. And so here's a question we can discuss later. Do you feel your childhood memories are the ones you remember best? Carr says, quote, "The whiff of cumin conjures your dad's curry," end quote. For you, perhaps there's another childhood smell from the kitchen that you remember. Are your childhood memories the most colorful for you somehow? Of course, we form strong, clear memories, too, of our adult years. And yet, if you close your eyes, can't you suddenly imagine the smells and sight and sound of your seventh grade classroom? How your new uniform felt a little itchy, how the new tie you wore felt a bit tight around your neck, or the backs of your knees stuck to the wooden seats, or maybe you got splinters in your finger from the wooden desk. How about the smell of summer grass with everyone sitting around in the sun studying for exams, the shade of oak trees, new leaves blown onto the grass by the spring wind. Those are some very clear memories for me that go back to grade 7, 8, and 9, and I'm sure you have your own memories. We all do. The first thing Mary Carr gets into is how powerful memory can be. The title of the first chapter, after all, is The Past's Vigor, its strength. In the first line of her chapter, Mary Carr says, "At unexpected points in life, everyone gets waylaid by the colossal force of recollection." So the words waylaid and colossal. Waylaid means someone attacked you on the way somewhere. You were sabotaged on the way. Colossal means really big, and it's a reminder of the ancient colossus of the city of Rhodes. This statue was so tall that it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. I'm going to show you a picture now, which is a screenshot from the TV show Game of Thrones, showing the island of Braavos, which had a statue imitating the Colossus. The Game of Thrones image illustrates the metaphor that Mary Carr is using. By using the word colossal, she says memory stops us with massive force. That's because emotion is powerful and threatening. It's mysterious. It does seem mysterious that childhood has this power over us, and yet it makes good psychological sense. If you know about different types of memory, if you've studied memory in a psychology course, you know that there is something called long-term memory and another thing called short-term memory. And if you have a relative with dementia, you know that their long-term memory lasts the longest. Their memories of childhood stay the longest. Their memories of who they were when they were young, these memories are the last to die. It's the memory of the recent past that disappears the fastest. The ability to build new memories also vanishes first. Our old memories stick around. So to me, this line from Louise Gluck's poem captures that insight about life. You don't have to be a psychologist to know that childhood makes a bigger impression on us than later years in life. Mary Carr doesn't dwell so much on the power of childhood. She also deals with the changeability of memories. According to Mary Carr, we can't really trust our memories. They change a lot. We're influenced by the power of the group, by groupthink. We're influenced by propaganda. Not political propaganda, but by whatever our family thinks, whatever our companions think. To illustrate how unpredictable memory is, she describes memory as, quote, a pinball in a machine. It messily ricochets around between image and idea, fragments of scenes, stories you've heard. Then the machine goes tilt and snaps off, end quote. I love this set of phrases. When she says memory is a pinball in a machine, it makes me think memory is violent, mobile, and volatile. Is that how memory is in your view? Or is a memory sometimes boring, staid, traditional, stuck? Like many of Mary Carr's sentences, it comes across to me sounding like poetry. The pinball, its motion, what happens to it, the break at the end, that's an extended metaphor, a very visual one, and a great image. And like the Louise Gluck quotation, what it does for me is point out the connection between memory and poetry. Mary Carr is a poet, and I think that's what makes her memoir so memorable. If you know that about her, it's no surprise that she chooses a poet's words to begin her memoir. So Louise Gluck's quotation at the start of the chapter is from her poem Nostos. And let's have a look at that poem quickly. The title of the poem means homecoming or return in Greek. The poem is clearly about a sort of return to childhood and a memory in childhood. In the poem, she questions what really happened in the past and what she actually knows. She questions whether she really knows it happened like that or not. And she says, quote, how many times, really, did the tree flower on my birthday? The exact day, not before, not after? What do I know of this place? So there's one idea in Louise Gluck's poem, the idea that we can't remember things well. Or whatever we remember, there's a sort of question as to whether it actually happened that way. That's also one of the main ideas of Mary Carr's first chapter. She reminds us of the inaccuracy of memory when she discusses the prank she plays on students in her class on memoir. She stages an argument with a fellow professor and then tests students to see what they remember and how well they remembered it. Most of them remember it wrong, she points out. Our memory makes mistakes. The story about her faking an argument with her colleague is the main story of hers that springs to mind when I think about this chapter. It's hard to remember all the things in the chapter because the structure of the chapter is not straightforward. It wanders all over the place, presenting one story after another from Carr's experience. And it's because of this lack of structure throughout the whole book that Gregory Cowles and the New York Times, who reviews the book, he thinks it's not a very good manual for memoirists. In fact, he says, and I quote, it's not, alas, a very good book. Repetitive, unorganized, unsure of its audience or tone, it can't decide whether it wants to be a how-to guide or a work of critical analysis. I would have voted for analysis myself. So that's what Cowles thinks, and I disagree. I think the art of memoir is a kind of memoir, basically. Mary Carr is aiming to illustrate what memoir should do rather than tell you how it should do it. When I was reading the book, I liked it mainly for its images and vivacity. I remember the book not for its advice, but for its colorful, funny stories. I also like the book because of its beautiful use of memoir. Every few sentences, you come across a really great metaphor. Like this one, a door to the past. She says on the first page that a door to the past blows open. And this reminds me of the children's book, A Wind in the Door. But what does she mean? She means that memoir is opening up our memories to us. It's allowing us to see the past again. And she's using a metaphor of access. Doors, windows, spaces that allow us to go somewhere new in order to experience another world. Memory and memoir allow us to experience the world in a different way, to learn something new about it. Another example of a metaphor is when she says, when we think about our memory, we, quote, pick at every knot until a thin thread comes undone that you can follow back through the mind's labyrinth to other places, end quote. In this metaphor, memory is not just a door, it's a labyrinth. It's a pathway. It's a mysterious pathway, one we have seen in dreams and legends, one that is exciting and beautiful, natural, maybe overgrown. The metaphor is relating to sewing, the ball of thread, and that reminds us of the story of Ariadne. In the ancient story, Ariadne was a princess. She gave her lover a ball of thread so that he could find his way back out of the labyrinth after killing a monster. Then he was able to marry her. But it didn't end well for Ariadne, and so that story about the labyrinth is a bit scary. And that's fair, because memory is scary sometimes. With all these metaphors, I think when you read The Art of Memoir, you have to keep in mind that Mary Carr is a poet. She's an excellent memoirist, and her writing is powerful because of her really distinctive narrative voice, her sense of humor, and her brilliance at depicting visual scenes. All of these things make her poetry and her memoir great. And when you read her Art of Memoir, I would not take it as a manual, really. It's more like a collection of fantastic bits of memoir along with commentary. It's disorganized, but on the other hand, disorganization is not a problem unless you're trying to write an essay. In the medieval tradition, it was typical for noted scholars to scavenge bits of readings from famous authors, the best bits, and then they wrote long, disorganized commentaries on those readings. That genre was called commentary, and so to me, this book is kind of a commentary on memoir. Basically, I think you need to read the book Art of Memoir without an eye to structure or how-to. This is not a self-help manual with charts or pictures or bullet points or call-outs or highlighted passages or flowcharts or statistics or anything like that. It's mainly a collection of great memoir passages along with some amusing and very insightful commentary on them. I want to talk now about the importance of life stories. Mary Carr's book on memoir was recommended to me by a friend who took a graduate course in biography. She and I were talking about writing fiction and how fiction can be developed from one's life story. Of course, you have to make some changes to it, but we agreed that some of the most outrageous things were not made up, they were lived through. My friend took graduate courses in biography, and she recommended a few other books for me, including one called Your Life as Story. That book is about how memoir gets turned into stories, stories that basically resemble fiction or novels in their structure. My friend's an editor, and her point was there are some common links between memoir and fiction. If you want to write good fiction and you want to base it on your life, go and read some good memoir. Go and read Mary Carr. Now, Mary Carr herself recommends that if you want to write memoir, you read a lot of it. So Mary Carr recommends some of the best memoirs to read, including Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which I read and loved, and this year have tried to get lots of people to read, including many of my students. Why would you want to write memoir is the question that you might raise, but I think that actually all of the things people like to write, memoir is one of the easiest types where we can explain motivation. Therapists often say we think of our lives in terms of a story. We think of our lives in terms of challenges we overcame or in terms of the meaning, the purpose of all events. Events only have meaning in the context of an overall purpose. Your life has meaning because of the purpose you give to it, and our happiness depends on the meaning we give to our stories. In fact, sociologists and philosophers do say that we determine our own view of happiness based on stories we tell ourselves, but there are different kinds of happiness. There's one kind of happiness that has to do with the moment we're living in. Do we feel comfortable, relaxed, optimistic? That's how we feel at the present moment. That question is whether we're having a good time right now, and that is sometimes thought of as hedonic happiness. Then there's another kind of happiness that relates to our judgment that we make about our life, about our past and our future. This would be thought of as eudaimonic happiness. The second kind of happiness relating to purpose has to do with how we feel about the path of our life. If we look at the pathway of our life, have we accomplished what we set out to do? Have we overcome the obstacles that we thought were insurmountable? And are we doing something meaningful? Are we living in a neighborhood that we judge to be quite nice? Whether or not we are satisfied has to do with the story we tell ourselves about how we got to the present moment, or where we are going, or how well we are doing at the present moment. Eudaimonic happiness also has to do with how we imagine explanations for why we did things in the past, reasons why we want to do things in the future. We tell ourselves stories that include a memory of a sequence of events. All of this type of thing is what shows up in memoir. Incidentally, these kinds of stories we tell ourselves are also the type of thing that shows up in fiction. Fiction and movies are places where we encounter thousands of stories that provide models for purpose and meaning. What is a good life? Watch a movie. Watch someone attain the good life by marrying the right person for them or changing the world for the better, and then we will learn what the purpose of our life could be too. Or perhaps we watch the movie so we can live vicariously through others. We can watch others fulfill their purpose or make their mistakes, and that makes us feel better for a while. Because we read so much fiction, we more and more expect memoirs to follow that form as well, and it does. The links between memoir and fiction have always been there, I think, but it's only recently that graduate writing programs focusing on memoir have sprung up around the world. You can take a master's in life writing, a master's in biography or memoir now, and if you write a PhD or master's thesis, you can critically analyze biographical writing. It's respectable and permissible to study this genre now. In fact, memoir is considered a literary genre just as respectable as fiction. But let's talk now about Mary Carr's chapter entitled On Information, Facts, and Data. I picked this chapter partly because of our culture's obsession with what we call information technology. I'm always checking news apps, and I imagine you are too. Social media pretends to give us all sorts of information. Being information literate is supposed to be a virtue. And yet what this chapter suggests to us is that information, the type we imagine putting into an Excel spreadsheet, information in itself is really not that helpful unless it's presented properly. And by that I mean we want information that tells us a story. For example, Mary Carr writes on page 123, information, quote, yanks the reader out of scenes, away from drama and lived experience, where the reader can watch external events and interpret them on his own. Getting fed bland information is like being preached to by a schoolmarm. So look at how Mary Carr uses the word yanks. To yank someone is to pull on them violently. Her idea is that information that is too dry, too boring, this sort of information really does not feel good. This kind of boring information makes us lose interest. We are being yanked out of something pleasant. Information that is boring, a confusing list of facts or dates, that kind of information will kill our enjoyment. Also think about how Mary Carr emphasizes showing rather than telling. Instead of simply telling us, do not use boring lists of dry information, she shows us what those lists do to us. She says, quote, when you use boring information, it will look as if you are pulling someone out of the interesting parts. It will be violently wrong. The idea that we should show more and tell less when we write is an idea from fiction. Teachers of fiction writing often say that writers should learn to show rather than tell, or that there should at least be a good balance of showing and telling. Showing is a kind of writing where the writer paints a picture for us in words. Usually, showing takes more words than telling does. Showing is more detailed. Showing involves using all five senses, touch, sound, taste, sight, and smell, to help the reader visualize a scene. But telling does none of these things. For example, I might say, as I did earlier, quote, "There was the smell of summer grass, with everyone sitting around in the sun, studying for exams. The shade of oak trees, new leaves blown onto the grass by the spring wind," close quotes. So that would be showing. Or I might write, quote, "We sat outside in the fresh air," close quote. That would be telling. Well, it's just a very small example. But here's another one. Open quotes. "What?" I said, as I felt a tear against my cheek, sniffled, and reached for a tissue. So that would be showing, as opposed to something like, "I started crying," which would be telling. Showing usually involves careful description of action and could involve dialogue, whereas telling usually summarizes. Here's an example where Carr illustrates that showing is better than telling. She writes, "I tried to hunch inside the new leather jacket, but my bony wrists stuck out." That's much better than telling us, quote, "I was self-conscious." It's much more memorable and much more visual. Interestingly, she shows us how to show by giving us a list. And she's just implied that lists are boring, but her list is an interesting list. She says, "I was 14 and 7 feet tall." And she says, look at how effective that statement is. They could have said, "I was tall at 14. Instead, "I was 14 and 7 feet tall" immediately gets our attention. We stop to imagine that image. Who was 7 feet tall? Have I ever known anyone 7 feet tall? But another reason I picked this chapter to focus on is that information seems to become a battleground these days in culture wars. Everyone thinks they have the monopoly on correct information. Fake news is all around us. And that is because of something that Mary Carr picks up on this chapter. She says to us that information is much more than information. She says, "Some facts hold so much drama or psychological interest, they prompt natural curiosity and a desire to know more." And when she says this, it underlines for us that information is not just bits of data. Depending on how you present the information, that information has the power to evoke strong emotions, and the information becomes really powerful. When the fact suggests a story to us, or when a fact is part of a larger story, information is no longer simple data. It's really charged and meaningful. Information presented in a dramatic way really has the power to influence and persuade people. So in this chapter, Mary Carr gives an example that is really telling in how it reframes the importance of information when it comes to our humanity. Mary Carr mentions the memoir by George Orwell, Homage to Catalonia. This is a well-written memoir, and I recommend it. Carr points out that Orwell gives a very human face to war. Orwell describes a boy's face and does not say which side of the war he fought on. The implication is that politics is uninteresting, but the reality of a human being is interesting. There's also the implication that if we see the human being, we will recognize them as a fellow human being, and we will not care so much about which side of the war they are on. We will maybe have compassion for them, even if we don't agree with their politics. But of course, if we have compassion for the individual, we automatically want to know more about them. We want to know what they believe and understand why they believe it. Suddenly, we become more receptive to information about this person because we see them as a person and not as a statistic. I think what this says is that narrative and the way we present information has a power to let us view humans as humans and not as numbers or pieces of paper. Instead of reading a simple description, like, for example, "This boy was a young soldier on the opposing side," we see him as a human being first and a soldier second. And here is a passage that Mary Carr mentions from George Orwell. "His peaked leather cap was pulled fiercely over one eye. He was standing in profile to me, his chin on his breast, gazing with a puzzled frown at a map which one of the officers had open on the table." And Mary Carr comments on this choice of images, and she says, "Rather than start with the political sects and conflicts within the revolutionary ranks, he focuses on his encounter with a single Italian freedom fighter. Orwell is writing about a person, though he is motivated strongly by politics. So for me, this reminds me of the fact that there's nothing naturally interesting in politics. Of course, that becomes obvious when someone tries to tell us about the politics of a country we do not care about. We are interested in politics only when it affects people we know or care about, and we care about people because of their stories and because of how their stories intersect with ours. So if we want to make political change, then we need to be able to tell stories effectively. We need to be able to use the information effectively to present it in dramatic ways. In this last part of the lecture, I want to talk about the preface in the book. For me, this raises the question of, when we write, do we start with meaning, or do we start with facts and events? And what are the connections between fiction and memoir? I usually skip the preface of the book, but the way Mary Carr writes, I don't mind reading it. What stands out to me in the preface is how Mary Carr sounds a lot like Natalie Goldberg in Writing Down the Bones or Anne Lamott in Bird by Bird. Anne Lamott is very much a memoirist, actually. All of them have really distinctive voices. They do not structure their writing in a typical essay fashion, although they are writing essays, but their writing is almost always amusing, visually appealing, and profound. So here are a few comments in the preface that really stick. Mary Carr says, "I once heard Don DeLillo quip that a fiction writer starts with meaning and then manufactures events to represent it. A memoirist starts with events and then derives meaning from them." But as readers of someone else's novels, we are always starting with events and deriving meaning from them. So novelists must be doing that too when they read their own work and consider how it is meaningful. And if we want to turn it around, people who think about their future are also beginning a story by beginning with purpose. When people think of their lives, they often think, what is the purpose of this? And then they shape the events of their lives to fulfill that purpose. They do something because of the purpose they believe in. So in a sense, we are creating our lives like a fiction writer writes a book. We also know that many novelists write what they know, so to speak, which often happens to be their own lives or parts of their lives. Of course, successful novelists don't write their life story in a dry and boring way. They lie and change things. They make it more interesting. But many novelists appear to draw from their own experiences. Margaret Lawrence, author of A Bird in a House and The Stone Angel, drew her characters from her life and her family's lives. More recently, Caitlin Moran wrote How to Be Famous, based essentially on her own life. And Marguerite Duras wrote The Lover, based partly on her own experiences. Charles Dickens's book David Copperfield weaves in some of his life experiences. Of course, we expect that since it's a novel, there's plenty that's untrue. But the power of these writers' narrative voices comes essentially from the fact that this voice exists partially in real life, too. That's why it sounds so real. And if we consider students, well, teachers these days are intent on getting our students to journal because they think it's the quickest, most effective way to get students writing. And for many students, it seems like a natural jump from writing memoir to writing fiction and poetry, imagining things that might have happened, or imagining on the page whatever dreams and fears come to mind. I'm going to sum up with the questions that we talked about at the end of this lecture. So the first question is, do you remember your childhood better than your adult years? And if so, why? That's how we started off this lecture, by talking about the quotation at the beginning of the book, which seems to suggest that we remember our childhood much better than our adulthood. Another question is, can you recall your memory of something that changed during your lifetime? So you remember it one way, but later you realize that it happened another way and you changed your mind about what happened. This is a really interesting experience because it makes you wonder why you remembered something in a particular way and then why you changed it later. Another question that touches on what Mary Carr deals with in her book is, do you have disagreements with your family about how things happened? And do these disagreements matter? Do they matter in the family? The last question I'm going to ask is about the metaphor, memory is a pinball in the machine. So what's your impression of memory? Is it like a pinball, kind of violent, mobile, and volatile? Is that how memory is? Or is memory sometimes boring and staid and traditional and stuck? These are very different ideas of memory. I guess memory can be a lot of different things. I think Mary Carr really brings out all of the range of different things that memory can be. Thanks for listening.